everyone.
Morning.
Isn't it a beautiful day for a Jukai ceremony? This is the best, Vancouver springtime when the cherry blossoms are out. It's always, there's that verse, you're not going to be able to say it exactly right, you know, but in the spring, in the winter, snowflakes, in the spring, cherry blossoms, in the summer, flowers, in the fall, the scarlet leaves, each season is the best. You know, it's I forget which old Zen master first said it, because then it kept being quoted, so you're not sure, you lose track of who actually said it. And it goes something like that. So today, seven of you will receive the Bodhisattva precepts and take your Bodhisattva vows. And those of us who have done it before will renew our vows along with you. And those of you who have never even seen or heard this done before can just open to what that is to take a vow. Especially like completely impossible ones, like the Bodhisattva vows. You know, what is that? Why would we do such a thing? Make these impossible vows. And one thing that really helps me actually is to, you know, when we chant, at the end of the Dharma talk, we'll chant, "Beings are numberless. I vow to save them." And because of the rhythm of English prosody, there's this beat that comes on the I. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. And that's really, it kind of throws us off, because we think, oh my gosh, how could I possibly save all beings? You know, little me. Well, right, it is impossible. And when we chant that in Sino-Japanese, there's no I. The subject's left out, and I really prefer it that way, because it reminds me that the only way that I can take these vows is for and with all beings together. That's how we awaken. There's no other way. And that within that, whatever I do or don't do or don't say makes a difference, no matter how small. So that's a way that we can make that huge commitment, which is at the same time a commitment to being awake right now in this moment. So we use this, we have fallen into a kind of rhythm of using a theme of Bodhisattva practice for this spring Jukai retreat in recent years. And this weekend, I decided to make the theme metta practice, loving kindness practice, unconditional friendliness practice, and to help us make that a Zen practice, not make it other than just sitting, but make it not separate from our Zen practice, which is why I suggested this morning, you know, that just as you sit and do the simple practice of shikantaza, just sitting with moment-to-moment awareness of what arises and passes, that we can make that also metta practice by the way that we, and compassion practice, by the way we meet that moment, by the way we meet our experience, the attitude that we bring to that we cultivate in that. So what I'm trying to do is offer a range of metta practice, from the very classical practice, which uses strongly phrases to concentrate the mind in that, the mind and body of metta, all the way to what I like to call street metta, or bus metta, or driving metta. You know, when somebody cuts me off in a very rude way, I like to breathe and say, may you get where you're going safely without harming yourself or others. I really, that's my practice. And it shifts that aggressive counter-response that I'm sure many of us have experienced, right? So we can practice. I do it with dogs. You know, you're out walking and, you know, rather overexcited dog is approaching and you're not quite sure. You know, I just send out goodwill, non-harming. They get it. Try it. You can see dogs get it. Because that's how they do it with each other, right? Non-verbally. This may sound woo-woo, but just try it. And we do it with each other too, right? They say at least 60% of communication is non-verbal. So if we cultivate that emanating non-harming, emanating goodwill, and we can practice on people who just get on the bus, right? Or I'm going to be getting on a plane very early tomorrow morning. I'll do plane metta, you know, for that baby who's crying because her ears hurt, right? Or whoever's grumpy on that plane, because probably half of them will be. Yeah, you know, so this is on-the-ground practice. So today I want to talk about metta for difficult people in the difficult world. You know, it's one thing to practice metta towards someone who's dear and you love very much. It's usually a little harder to practice it for yourself. And it can be really hard if you're practicing it for someone who has hurt you badly, or who has hurt a lot of other people badly. How do you do that? You know? So there are some complex questions that arise. You know, we were asking some, you know, sort of questions that sound philosophical, but they are also on the ground questions about happiness. You know, because of course we say, may you be happy, may I be happy, when we do metta practice. How can we be happy? How can we wish for happiness in a world where there's so much suffering? And that was one of the things I really wanted to bring out yesterday, is this even more essential to have the capacity for happiness and joy if we're going to have the capacity to be present with suffering and not turn away? Those capacities are not in opposition. They're not separate from each other. They're the same capacity to be present, to see deeply into the suffering in our world and the roots of it, is not other than our capacity for joy and receiving the sweetness and beauty of the world and of each other. So another, you know, another question that philosophers and theologians have wrestled with for centuries is what we mentioned yesterday: is happiness even possible in this world? Or is any semblance of happiness nothing but illusion? I'll touch back on that. And how can we wish for happiness for those who cause harm and suffering to others? These are big questions, aren't they? You know, and they're not just abstract. They play out in our daily lives. So not only the philosophers and theologians, but ordinary people like us have to live these questions. You know that beautiful quote from Rilke, from Letters to a Young Poet, where he says something like, here, I'm going to paraphrase again, because I'm just making this up. I didn't put this in the talk. But he says something like, you don't you don't know the answers to the questions now, he's speaking to this young poet, but you must live the answers, live into the answers, live the questions, he says. That's how he puts it. Live the questions. And the answers come over a long life in little whispers and flashes and moments. Yeah, so these are living questions. Jeremy Bentham was a British utilitarian philosopher, and he put forward this principle of the greatest happiness for the greatest number as the measure of right and wrong and social policy. The greatest happiness for the greatest number, and the measure of happiness was based simply on relative pleasure versus pain. So how does that weigh out? What if acquiring the greatest amount of pleasure for one group of people, who are the majority, is at the cost of great pain and suffering for another group of people who are the minority? According to him, that's fine. Another utilitarian, Francis Edgeworth, even imagined the possibility of what he called a psychophysical machine to do what he called hedonic calculus. The measurement of pleasure. How do you do that? you know that word, hedonics? Yeah, from you know, hedonism, hedonist, pleasure, love of pleasure. So hedonic calculus, yeah. I remember many years ago receiving a catalog in the mail. Remember when catalogs used to come in the mail? It's called hedonics. And it had all these like things and it was very male at that time, for the man who has everything. And there are all these kind of gadgets, fairly expensive gadgets. This is a hedonics catalog. So I just Googled it, and it still exists online, the hedonics catalog. And you can get on sale two for $19.99 hidden wall safes that go behind the electrical outlet. Did you know? Did you know you wanted one of those? Or an avocado peeler. You get three avocado peelers for $24.99. These items might make you feel, you know, a little kind of excited buzz when they come in the mail, because you don't get much mail anymore, right? And then you open up, and they end up in the back of the drawer, taking up space, clogging up your drawer, right? And you forget about them. You know, there's that little buzz when they when you first try them out. And then the little wall safe gets jammed because it's made out of plastic, and you complain. But harmless enough, you might say, a useless avocado peeler. But what are we to make of the tons of toxic waste from our discarded digital devices that may be shipped across the Pacific Ocean to be picked up for recycling by unprotected children in China or Bangladesh? What are we to make of that? Because of the speed of technological change and the effectiveness of consumer brainwashing, the length of time we keep our devices is getting steadily smaller, like less than 2 years that people replace many of their devices these days. Seems a bygone age when families would keep a TV for a decade or two decades even. So it gets complex, doesn't it, weighing whose pleasure takes precedence. Yeah, what if one person's happiness or desires cause harm or deprivation to someone else? Whose right to happiness prevails? What if one person or group believes that their well-being depends on carrying arms to defend themselves and their property from those they perceive to be a threat. And in doing that, they end up killing innocent people and shattering those families. Whose happiness is gained and whose is lost? And happiness at what cost? John Stuart Mill, Bentham's disciple, really struggled with this issue, you know, greatest happiness for the greatest number. And he came to the conclusion that the quality of well-being, not just the quantity, needs to be assessed, and that virtue or morality or truth also has a role to play. We talked about that yesterday in terms of the Greek virtues and the Buddhist paramitas. And that often one of these factors, truth, morality, virtue, will trump the simple pleasure pain equation, that other values come in determining our behavior. And isn't it a measure of being a mature, fully actualized human being to be able to forego immediate gratification of pleasure for our own long-term well-being or for the benefit of others? Right? Isn't that one of the basic things children have to learn? Is sometimes you wait. You don't get what you want right away. And you might not get it at all, but it might not turn out to be what you really wanted. Right? That's what children learn. Sometimes we act like great big kids who didn't learn that. So sometimes we choose to act and speak in accord with the values of truthfulness, generosity, kindness, etc., right? And isn't there a kind of happiness, or what we might call it a quiet joy, that comes from connecting to the world around us with that kind of genuineness, connection, even in painful situations, that goes beyond the hedonic calculus? Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us that happiness is not an individual matter, and that when we look deeply into the roots of our suffering, we see that it is connected to the suffering of our ancestors, our family history, our cultural history, our human history. We see that the roots of our suffering are entangled deeply into the very soil of our existence. The earth itself and the systems that support our lives. So how could our happiness not be the same? How could our happiness not be entirely entwined with the well-being of others and with the earth and the earth systems? So to walk the Bodhisattva path and to take up the Bodhisattva vows, we must deeply realize and live this reality. And because we are conditioned beings with many habit patterns inherited over generations, we blow it over and over and over again, right? In small and large ways. And so we see that. We see it with kindness. We see it with that kind of affectionate curiosity that metta is. And we renew our intention, we renew our vows over and over throughout our lives. And we look clearly, without guilt, without toxic guilt, but with our wide open Dharma eye, we look at how even our best intentions get contaminated and compromised by our greed, aversion, and ignorance. You know, the three poisons. Even in subtle ways, it gets even more subtle. So this is an inexhaustible practice, right? And simply by living in this world, being part of human systems and institutions in which greed, aversion, and ignorance are entrenched, we are implicated. And that can seem overwhelming, and many of us feel the immensity of the challenges that we face in the world right now. Maybe not so different from other times in history, but it feels pretty big right now. And yet that there is something in this view that we're being offered by the Dharma that gives us freedom. It gives us freedom to respond from a place of spaciousness and not self-focus and self-clinging. So we can see deeply into these causes and conditions as far as we can. We can't see all the way. You know, there's so much we can't see or fully understand. But without that terrible, harsh judgment of self or others, or if it does arise, we soften it. We breathe. We soften it. And we release our discouragement and despair so that we can respond, connect with kindness, patience, and determination. This is not mushy. We're not talking about something that's mushy or sentimental here. There's a certain place for determination and firmness as we practice. So, in practicing with these Brahmaviharas, these noble abodes, starting with metta, because traditionally metta is the first because it's most accessible, you know, kindness. And then compassion focuses more on the actual suffering in oneself or others. So we start with metta, to kind of tenderize, you know, tenderize our heart and mind. And we start, as we said yesterday, with ourselves and with those, and then those who are, we feel it's pretty easy to feel kindness towards. And then we move on to those who are more challenging, right? Those who we see as causing pain or suffering or even just annoyance, you know, like that really, really annoying person at work. To ourselves or to those we care about or our values, you know, all those ways that we feel threatened. So we need to realize that our happiness does not depend on changing their behavior. That's kind of what we think. That's kind of what we really believe, is, you know, that we'd be happy if they'd be different. But actually, no. Our happiness is our own inner orientation. And our purpose in doing this practice is also not to change these people. And at the same time, we realize that fundamentally our well-being and theirs are not separate. Like I just said, the roots go so deep. And that those deep, deep roots are our common ground in the human condition, even with those who have done the most horrific acts of cruelty. We stand on the same ground of the human condition. So yesterday, when we began to practice metta for ourselves, we considered how you can't really go deeply into metta practice without being willing to attend to aversion arising. This is equally important when we're turning towards difficult people, because in all likelihood, fear or anger, aversion will arise when we think about that, you know, bring that person to mind. So we're not just trying to make ourselves feel like fonts of loving kindness, because we probably won't be if we think, you know, if we're bringing to mind someone who has frightened us or hurt us. We're not trying to gloss over the pain or the fear or the anger we may feel towards that person. I'm going to read you a passage from Christina Feldman's book, and I'm going to pitch this book again because I really appreciate it. And she says this so clearly and beautifully. She says, if we listen closely to the moments of aversion and the moments of kindness in our days, there are two important aspects to notice. Aversion, whether in small ripples or larger waves, is a generator of narrative. I'm sure we've all noticed that, right? Yeah, the story cranks up, or the old tapes of those conversations or arguments, right? Aversion is a generator of narrative. The intensity of the aversion tends to determine the length and intensity of the narrative that arises. We are prone to obsess about those we fear and dislike. Someone offends us, we feel our reaction and resistance arising, and the beginning of the story about that person. Soon we have isolated every single thing that is unacceptable about that person. You know? What they said 10 years ago piles on top of what they said yesterday. Right? We may hardly even know the person yet. Yet we weave enough narrative and conviction in the narrative through aversion to condemn him or her to being a lifelong enemy. It is also noticeable that the strength of the sense of I, of me, is determined by the strength of the aversion that arises and the solidity that is given to the other. With the narrative grows the separation between I and other. Distance and separation in turn will become the breeding grounds of fear and the festering of ill will. If we listen closely to the moments of unhesitating kindness that can arise in our day, because as we said yesterday, this is a natural part of us. It does arise spontaneously and naturally. If we notice those, it also becomes clear that in those moments there is far less narrative, right? The sense of a centralized I or self is almost imperceptible, and those moments leave no residues in the mind in terms of shame or judgment. In the moments of kindness we encounter, and sometimes we're on the giving, or sometimes we're on the receiving side, right? There's a quality of joy, a sense of relatedness, and a decreasing in the volume of both the sense of I and the sense of other. So as we continue with this practice in our little bit of time we have left today, please be guided by this way of approaching metta. You might want to choose someone who is not the most challenging or harmful person in your life to start with. Someone towards whom you may feel a moderate or manageable level of aversion, frustration, or annoyance for practice. And begin to use the metta phrases that we've mentioned. May you be happy. May you be free from harm. May you be safe. May your heart be at ease. Use the ones that make sense to you. You can use the phrases to help strengthen your concentration, or you can just use that felt sense of openness, warmth, friendliness, even if it's just a little, you know. Don't try and make yourself make it big if it doesn't feel big. Start where it is. And touch into your deepest wish for them to be free from greed, hatred, and ignorance. Because that's true, that's where true happiness lies. And of course, we wish that for the most terrible people in the world. We wish them to be free from the torment of their greed, hatred, and ignorance, because then they'd be free and they wouldn't do harm. Yesterday we asked some questions about what happiness is. Does it depend on having things, or does it depend on other people treating us the way we want them to? Is happiness simply illusory? Since, as the Buddha taught, everything is impermanent and without self-existence, right? Is happiness only achievable in a heavenly afterlife, as many Christians have believed, especially in times when life on earth has been really full of hardship and suffering for most people? Or after countless rebirths, as the early Buddhist teachings seem to suggest? Or is happiness right here and now, in any moment when self-clinging drops away and the myriad thing, the world comes forward to meet us, as Dogen Zenji famously describes, you know, and to study the self, to study the way is to study the self, to study the self is to forget the self, to forget the self is to be actualized by the 10,000 things. Body and mind fall away, and body and mind of all things fall away along with us. This is something we can wish, even for our worst enemies, can't we? So when we do this practice for the most difficult people, those who have hurt us or others, we have to attend to the state of our own heart and mind as we go, noticing when the heart contracts, when fear and distress arise. So again, I'm going to call on Christina Feldman to help us with this. She has lots of experience. She says, there are moments when it can be skillful to use the metta practice more as a concentration practice, to use the articulated phrases of the intentions of metta to hold us steady. She says, the human mind does not entertain two thoughts at the same moment. Much as we like to multitask, really, you can't think two things at the same time. And we have choices about the thoughts we sustain. It is far wiser and kinder to establish our attention in thoughts that are conducive to our well-being than in thoughts that inflict more harm upon us. In the moments when our mind feels gripped by aversive narrative, we can use the metaphrases in a more continuous and unbroken way. So you can be skillful in your practice. You don't have to just do it by rote. Metta is... Oops, I slipped. Yeah. Metta is not a one-dimensional cultivation using only the phrases. Aversion and fear are somatic and affective experiences shaping our mind and body of the moment. Yeah, shaping our mind and body of the moment. We can learn to stay close to those experiences and imprints, exploring them with mindfulness, softening rather than hardening, opening and embracing rather than closing, and learning it is possible to befriend all events and experiences. So to me, this just really makes this a spacious and dynamic practice that can help us really learn a lot about ourselves. So practicing this way with difficult people does not condone or excuse the harm that they've done, but it looks deeper into the causes and conditions that led to that harm. And as I've said, it's a deep wish for freedom for ourselves and them. for victims and perpetrators, for oppressed and oppressors, how else are we to find a way of living in peace on this earth? One of the things I read in preparing for this retreat was a book called Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle by a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, Chris Hedges. He served for years as a war correspondent in some of the most damaged parts of our world. And it's a pretty grim accounting, actually, of our current cultural condition. He ticks off the illusion of literacy in a chapter about celebrity culture, reality TV, and sensationalist news. Next chapter, the illusion of love, is a discussion of pornography. The illusion of wisdom is a chapter on the corporate and military co-optation of institutions of higher education. Chapter on illusion of happiness, he skewers the ideology of positive psychology that refuses to look at our shadow side. And his chapter on the illusion of America just sounds prophetic, written before the most recent president arrived on the scene. It's not cheerful reading. But in his concluding pages, remarkably, he comes around to the power of human kindness. It takes him a long time to get there. I think... couldn't you have kind of woven it in a little bit more? But he says this. He's not optimistic about the prospects for Western civilization. He says, I'm not naive about violence, tyranny, and war. I have seen enough of human cruelty. But I've also seen in conflict after conflict that we underestimate the power of love. The power of a Salvadoran archbishop, even though he was assassinated to defy the killing. The power of a mayor in a small Balkan village to halt the attacks on his Muslim neighbors. He says, no tyranny in history has crushed the human capacity for love, for small acts of kindness and compassion, even at the risk of our own well-being and in the midst of the most horrific circumstances. This love is deeply subversive to those in power. Or we could say from a Buddhist perspective, this love is deeply subversive to the power of greed, hatred, and ignorance. So we are doing a radical and subversive practice, in case you didn't realize. and a necessary practice, not only for our personal well-being, but to whatever extent we can heal and open our own hearts and minds, the benefit will extend far beyond what we can imagine or ever know. In the traditional sequence of metta practice, we conclude by expanding our circle of kindness and care to all beings in the entire earth, so we can direct our attention to include categories of beings, like the forests, the oceans. The oceans are in trouble, you know, so they could use our attention and our action. The ocean dwellers, the displaced, the homeless, those without enough to eat, and ultimately to all beings, everywhere. May all beings be safe from harm. May all beings live in peace. May all beings be free from suffering. These are the wishes of a bodhisattva. These are our wishes. So let's conclude by chanting the bodhisattva vows together. And thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you for your practice. And you all keep us upright and practicing with you. May our intention equally extend to